I've just started talking about the essay Great Men by Ralph Waldo Emerson. I've just read the paragraph on page 20. I guess it's on page 26.
Yeah.
Am That's, I writing that? I read the wrong paragraph. I read on page 26. I meant to read on 28. So nobody's missed anything at all.
I thought that's what you said, and then I thought I misunderstood you.
Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, here's page 28. Let me read it. Our common discourse respects two kinds of use or service from superior men. Direct giving is agreeable to the early belief of men. Direct giving of material or metaphysical aid, as of health, eternal youth, mind, senses, arts of healing, magical power, and prophecy. The boy believes there is a teacher who can sell him wisdom. Churches believe in imputed merit. But in strictness, we are not much cognizant of direct serving. Man is endogenous, and education is his unfolding. The aid we have from others is mechanical compared with the discoveries of nature in us. What is thus learned is delightful in the doing, and the effect remains. Right ethics are central and go from the soul outward. Gift is contrary to the law of the universe. Serving others is serving us. I must absolve me to myself. Mind thy affairs, says the spirit, coxcomb. Would you meddle with the skies or with other people? Indirect service is left. Men have a pictorial or representative quality in service in the intellect. Behmen and Swedenborg saw that things were representative. Men are also representative, first of things and secondly of ideas. Okay, that's the passage I meant to read. So, what does that mean? What's he saying here?
I think he's saying that when you're young, you need to have someone guide you and teach you, but as you get older, you need to move beyond that to be your own teacher.
Okay. At first, we have to receive things directly. Then we have to learn how to receive them indirectly. And that's where we connect with the sources at the abstract level of the mind. The reason why I had marked the passage on page 26 is, I didn't mean to read the whole paragraph, but he says, our religion is the love and cherishing of these patrons. Now, the interesting thing is, in Spanish, as we've been translating The Light Within Us, I've discovered that the word archetype translates as patron. And patron is the same word as our word patron. And Emerson is using that almost in this sense, that a patron is a patron of the arts, or the owner of a store. He's the source of giving or whatever. And we're meant to view the patrones, the archetypes of the abstract mental plane, as sources of gifts and giving that we can access indirectly. First, we need great men to show us the way, and then we learn from them and we climb on the backs of their great. He goes on and says, a magnet must be made man before the general mind can come to entertain its powers. How is a great man a magnet? And that is magnet, not maggot.
I think we're drawn to people, even if it's in retrospect, as we talk about Lincoln and all these people who seem to be beyond human, that they had such a perspective on truth, on what the main impact of humanity, that look at them as heroes. I mean, I love what he talked about, just their physical presence, how we exaggerate their beauty, you know, and just their presence among us. We're drawn to them.
Okay. Any other input here?
I would also say we could learn from them to be able to receive indirectly, to learn how to do it on our own.
Okay.
There was a quote in here, and I can't find it, on a friend. And it was how a friend's love changes your life, makes you believe in yourself. And I think friendliness would be one of these great people who teaches us that we no longer have lost our confidence all of a sudden. Our life is different, it's not the same.
Okay. Yes.
You can make many also because
well, yes, I think the magnetic aspect of their presence is the very force of spirit that they work with. Rose and I watched a video on Van Gogh the other night, about a week ago. I think I mentioned this on Monday probably. But, he was consumed with the urge to paint, and in 10 years of painting, he painted 900 pictures. And the last couple of months, he painted 3 or 4 paintings a day. And his contact with it's clear that many of his paintings have great power in them. And I think that's what unbalanced him and why he killed himself was he couldn't handle. He just literally burst under the strain of handling all this creative energy. That's an extreme. Most artists and writers and musicians find a way to harness the creative energy without being and directed into their canvas or their work rather than maintaining it themselves. He just couldn't. The cup got too worn down. Yes, Rose.
Also, it could be seen as an example of right timing because his brother died shortly after that,
mm-hmm.
and that was his support. His financial support was from his brother,
right,
who would no longer have been able to support him.
Right. So it may be that there was a combination of factors there that
came together in right timing.
Right. The power of this magnetic presence is such that if you go to visit the shrine of a Catholic saint and there's any relic there, the relic is filled with the intensity. Or if you go visit the home they lived in, the quality of energy found in those places is sublime and extraordinarily powerful. They do bring heaven to earth. And this is an important idea for people to grasp early in their development. Heaven is constantly coming to earth. When the Bible says that God made man in his own image, he doesn't mean visage. It means we are designed to be creative as our Father in heaven is creative, and we're designed to work with heavenly powers. Other input. Yes, Rose.
Well, as the genius contacts the idea and starts bringing it down, that gives humanity all sorts of levels at which they can aspire to. You know, if you can't get to the highest level, but then there's one below that and one below that and one below that. So everybody has the opportunity to be inspired at whatever level they can reach that idea.
Well, to put that in a slightly different way, I'm shameless, but I will anyway. What we need to understand is that growth occurs in the human family by quantum leaps.
Oh.
And I think I have a seminar coming up in a week on that. If you haven't sent in your tuition, be sure to do so. But we study avatars in the ancient wisdom, the spiritual biz here. We study avatars and whatnot. And we think, oh, well, those are unreachable. The Christ was an avatar. But Western Christianity teaches that we should love the Christ, but we can never be the Christ. Of course, the Christ said, everything I've done, you can do in greater things. The esoteric way of defining a great man, as Ralph Waldo is defining it, is an elder brother. Somebody who has gone a little bit further down the road than the rest of us and comes into the earth incarnation to show us the way down the road, the way to future growth. They're elder brothers. And they don't say, listen to me because I'm a great man. They say, let me help you.
Well, basically, that's what DK says in the beginning of the book.
Right.
I've just been at it a little bit longer than all of you.
Yeah, and made one or two fewer mistakes. Taken one or two more opportunities. Well, maybe dozens more. But it's important to put that all into this context, and that's why Emerson is not idolizing great men, but trying to evaluate the role they play in sowing the seeds of the next generation or two of human development.
But the idea that it is available to absolutely everybody.
Right.
It keeps trickling down, and at every level you can discover it.
Yes.
It's up to you, but it is there to be discovered.
Mm-hmm. Let me read a little bit more, and then we'll talk some more. This is on page 31. Yes.
I was just going to say that it seems to me that every time you have a new good thought or learn something new, you've actually helped raise humanity.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought that point was so clear in this. And at the same time, I want to say, why can't he write work?
Because he
is a genius, obviously. But after I read this, I read all the Federalist Papers that you've included in Sophie.
Yeah.
And they were a joy to read. These men really have the ability to write difficult ideas very simply. And he is hard slogging.
Yeah, it is hard to read.
Well, it's one of those things. The Federalist Papers were written with the object of persuading. They were written to convince people to approve the Constitution, to be in favor of that.
Right.
So they were written with the goal of clarity. Now, I'm not saying that Emerson doesn't have the goal of clarity, but his definition of clarity is a little bit more. He's trying to wrap nuggets in expensive silks and that in fine boxes and so on. In other words, there's thoughts within thoughts within thoughts. He's trying to stimulate the mind and force people to slow down.
You can't speed read
well,
it.
Well, okay, fine. But I will compliment you in that you seem to try to encourage people to think, and yet you do it in an elegant, simple way that is very accessible. I simply find Emerson to be like, it's almost, oh, geez, not him again, because he is so darn hard to read, and I spent 20 minutes my dictionary when I was done with it.
Well, good, good.
I thought too. I had my Kindle dictionary.
First of all, the check is in the mail. Thank you for those statements.
No, I'm really comparing and contrasting, and I'm not disputing the fact his ideas are brilliant. That's not my point. They are, and he's very inspiring in that way.
That's stretching.
Just a nightmare to read.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. DK is not too easy to read either, not because he's unclear, but because he's talking about things which are beyond our ken, our standard level of understanding. I'm not going to apologize for Emerson. All I can say is the more you read him, the easier it becomes to understand him. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, no. Why did I open my mouth?
Oh, no. One of the great motivating factors of Sophie, which keeps them coming, because God knows we have almost no subscribers, but one of the things that keeps me doing them is that it gives me an opportunity to go back and highlight Emerson and Thoreau and other great thinkers that have written in English, some of which are more understandable than others, but it's important. You know, you heard me say this before. The first time I read the Dunciad by Pope, I had to read it three times in one night in order to begin understanding it. And now I can speed read Alexander Pope, but it's taken a long time to get there.
Okay, suppose we just need to get on his wavelength a little bit.
That is part of it. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to disrupt.
No, that's an excellent
really?
Point. That's an excellent point.
Wow.
There is a school of thought among esotericists that you challenge people to come to your level, you don't bring it down. And so there is some element of doubt in my mind that I oversimplify in the name of lucidity. But I don't think so. I don't lose sleep at night over it. Rose.
Before you go on, I had a question on page 28.
Page 28, Rose has a question.
Down at the bottom where he says, each man is, by secret liking, connected with some district of nature whose agent and interpreter he is. Now, I interpreted that as your soul and personality rays.
Right.
Really would be what he would be talking about there.
Exactly. Dr. Bache or Bach or whatever his name was, mm-hmm. had an affinity for the emotional element of plants.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's saying here. There's an affinity, a secret liking. That is part of it too, Judy, is that he's taking ideas that he's bringing in from the inner levels and from other traditions where words don't exist in his vocabulary, and he has to describe them as best he can. I mean, I can sit here and talk about avatars, and you all know what I mean. If he had used the word avatar, nobody would comprehend what it was at all, so he has to figure out a way to describe that. And I think that contributes to the difficulty of reading Emerson, where it wouldn't be a problem with the Federalist Papers, other than the fact that they need to define liberty and freedom and things like that. Okay. Yes.
Didn't he, in a few sentences, also try to explain evolution, like of humanity?
Probably. What do you have in mind?
Excuse me.
Do you have a particular quote in mind, or just is that just a general statement?
Well, I mean, I think he was talking.
Sure. Okay.
And he actually talks about how one form becomes a walking and then thinking, and you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. And these were new ideas that were new to his readers.
Yeah.
And so he's inventing the vocabulary of these thoughts. Okay, over on page 31. The paragraph beginning, we are too passive. Let me mute this so you can understand it as I read it. We are too passive in the reception of these material or semi-material aids. We must not be sacks and stomachs. I wonder if that's Saks Fifth Avenue. We must not be sacks and stomachs. To ascend one step, we are better served through our sympathy. Activity is contagious. Look where others look, and conversing with the same things, we catch the charm which lured them. Napoleon said, you must not fight too often with one enemy, or you will teach him all your art of war. Talk much with any man of vigorous mind, and we acquire very fast the habit of looking at things in the same light, and on each occurrence, we anticipate his thought. So what's he getting at here?
Well, to use a trite example, they say, I watch some sports, and they say, for example, in basketball, if you play one team very often, you figure out, you know, their moves and stuff, and it's easier to beat them.
Right, except for the fact that they're doing the same thing in reverse. And so that's a process of learning, but then the learning gets more difficult. As you step it up, they step it up. That's often not discussed. Other input here. The reason for bringing that up is the beginning of the paragraph more than the end of it. We are too passive. And that's the key here, is if we're actively involved with the thoughts and ideas of great men, there's no danger of this happening. But when we're passive and we simply swallow everything we are told, then we need the examples of lots of great men to keep us honest, because it is passivity. Passivity is the greatest threat to clear thinking, to understanding. Yes, well.
So then our Thinking Out Loud group is people get together and they all contribute. You
right.
don't just sit there and not say anything.
Right. Basically,
in one sense,
he's saying, if during the whole day here I just lectured and didn't ask for your input, I would lull you into passivity. And that's a no-no. Now, there are times like when I teach courses, and I'm teaching something that you're not familiar with, like when I teach the basic course, most of that has to be lecture because I'm presenting to you techniques that you need to understand. But in the seminars, I ask you to participate, and it's the interaction of your thinking. It's not my thinking that counts. It's your thinking that makes the course work. If I'm a good teacher, I get you thinking and contributing and challenging ideas that you've held for a long time. And that's what the role of a teacher is. The teacher to students is the great man or the great woman who, I mean, the teacher may not be an Emerson by any means, but to young skulls of mush, as Rush would call them, the teacher is the great person who now must encourage each student to be active and challenge and think on their feet and not just accept and regurgitate. When Mamet makes the point in his book, The Secret of Knowledge, that students are taught and encouraged and expected to do nothing more than regurgitate the pablum they've been fed. And that's what's wrong with the educational system.
So it's back to the teacher being the magnet drawing forth
right.
from the student.
Right. Okay. Any other comments on that?
I found another example I've read this time, and it has to do with action. Because the first time I read this, that one sentence excited me, and action is contagious.
Where's that?
This is on page 43. It's kind of about a fourth of the way there. I'm starting to quality of mind travels by night and by day in concentric circles from its origin and publishes itself by unknown methods. The union of all minds is intimate. What gets admission to one cannot be kept out of any other. The smallest acquisition of truth or of energy in any quarter is so
much good to the common good of souls.
Yes, I have the same
thing. Yes. Okay, so what does that mean?
Well, it's just like these geniuses or these people who teach us, or as they're affecting humanity in any way, we're all being affected by that. The union of all minds appears in humanity.
And why is that?
Well, because we're connected.
It's because they're working at the abstract mind of God. They're working in the mind of God. The connection is pre-existent. You can, as I've said many times, you cannot think a thought all by yourself. It's instantly broadcast, and anybody on the same wavelength picks it up at the same time. So
this is what Judy was just saying before. If you have a thought, it affects everyone. So your smallest acquisition of truth or energy in any order. So much good to
come. Exactly. And so this is the dynamic element of training the mind, learning to think. Once you have gotten to the point where your mind is under control and you're not thinking ludicrous thoughts and destructive thoughts, then you start working at the abstract level, and every insight you get becomes an outside. You don't have to convey it to anybody. You don't have to write about it. Just the thinking process stimulates the minds of other people.
It is, when you went into the store to look at the carpet, to me, when that image, I thought, all right, those designs in the carpet are almost like what we learned from Plato or whatever. They're right there. We're picking up on that. That's
right.
Something new. It's something that has been with us.
Yes. Yes.
As you were reading that paragraph on page 21, it helped keep in on that word, sympathy, and there was an element of resonation to that word in order to have the interest. But I think that might suggest resonation, which what happens is attention to this great looking at things in the same light, you have to be affected by their resolution and getting on the same wavelength. I thought, too, that then played out in the narrative said,
sure, which of course is reminds us of Eureka by Poe. But also, this whole principle is the basis of the pattern of genius technique from active meditation. And I hope everybody uses that technique at least once a week, because nothing stimulates the mind more than if that pattern of genius technique is designed to set up that resonance, that sympathy. If Emerson were writing today, he'd probably use the word empathy rather than sympathy. Sympathy is the correct word, but it's been abused in the last 50 years to mean something different. Okay, moving ahead on page 33, the paragraph starting, we go to the gymnasium. We go to the gymnasium and the swimming school to see the power and beauty of the body. There is the like pleasure and higher benefit from witnessing intellectual feats of all kinds as feats of memory, of mathematical combination, great power of abstraction, the transmutings of the imagination, even versatility and concentration, as these acts expose the invisible organs and members of the mind which respond member for member to the parts of the body. For we thus enter a new gymnasium, and learn to choose men by their truest marks, taught with Plato to choose those who can, without aid from the eyes or any other sense, perceive the truth and to be. That's his way of referencing the intuition, which, again, he dared not define directly, or he'd lose all of his congregational parishioners. And yet this is an important point. So let me mute here. Any comments or questions on this?
I like the next sentence, no problem. out.
Go ahead and read it.
This foremost among these activities are the somersault, the spells, and resurrection brought by the American Indian. So just stressing that abstract, that's the real somersault.
Well, and the next line, when this wakes, a man seems to multiply 10 times or 1,000 times his force. And Dr. Lykman has, from time to time, said that in terms of IQ, the IQ of a genius has to be measured in terms of 2,000 or 3,000 rather than 150. We're talking about the true creative genius, not the intellectual genius.
This sort of reminded me of when in meditations you say we are in the mind of God.
We're in the mind of God. Very good point. Other points on this? Right. The gymnasium of the mind.
Right.
And I make no apologies about focusing on that criterion. Over on page 34, he says, at the bottom, let me mute for a moment. But nature brings all this about in due time. Rotation is her remedy. The soul is impatient of masters and eager for change. Housekeepers say of a domestic who has been valuable, she had lived with me long enough. We are tendencies, or rather symptoms, and none of us complete. We touch and go and sip the foam of many lives. I like that line. We sip the foam of many lives. Rotation is the law of nature. When nature removes a great man, people explore the horizon for a successor, but none comes and none will. His class is extinguished with him. In some other and quite different field, the next man will appear. Not Jefferson, not Franklin, but now a great salesman, then a road contractor, then a student of fishes, then a buffalo hunting explorer, or a semi-savage Western general. Thus we make a stand against our rougher masters. But against the best, there is a finer remedy. The power which they communicate is not theirs. When we are exalted by ideas, we do not owe this to Plato, but to the idea to which also Plato was debtor. And so in this passage, there's several key reasons for reading this. One is this whole notion about rotation. And there's a... The intelligence of life always manages to bring in a proper mix from the savage or the semi-savage to the enlightened individual so that growth can occur. If all we had was a collection of 10 enlightened individuals, they wouldn't stimulate anybody to grow. They'd all compare notes as to how they'd grown. But the force that stimulates growth is the wide diversity of achievement at any point in time on Earth. And that means that Hugo Chavez can rear up and gain control, but also it means that people like Emerson can influence, and we're still reading Emerson's ideas after 150 years, and Hugo Chavez will be forgotten before he's even dead. And then the final point, we are exalted by ideas. We don't owe our genius to Plato. We owe them to the ideas Plato also served. And I think that's such an important point. Any further insights or comments on that?
I read that in the rotation. Somehow I was connecting Aristotle and Benjamin Franklin.
Okay.
They both were so inventive and so broad in their quest. I mean, he was dissecting animals, and it wasn't just philosophy. I mean, his mind went all over the place.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, the secret is that we set the tone of many lives, and so it is true that I don't know about the Aristotle-Franklin connection. It's plausible. Doesn't matter. But one can assume that great men have been great men in the past, maybe not as great as the one time, but that depends upon human embracing. But there's no question that great men continue to be great men when they appear in lives that are noted and recorded. And that's in
the going to the next page.
Well, you have a...
On that same page,
yeah.
or 35,
yeah.
Partway down where he says, in lucid intervals we say, let there be an entrance open for me into realities. I have worn the fool's cap too long. That, to me, when you are able to make that statement, you are responding to the evocation of the soul.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, over on page 37, thus we feed on genius. Not sure where that is. It must be buried in here somewhere. Well, if I can't find it, we'll skip it. Maybe I have the wrong page in my notes. What about it?
Well, it's something about the inability of men, how they're dazzled by the power, the blind power, and it's the genius seems to be hopeless from this thought. And I thought that was such a wonderful line, because the genius really is trying to step down many concepts so that others can understand it, not trying to dazzle them, leave them the power.
Yeah, we need to read the first sentence, the sentence just before that. The imbecility of man is always inviting the impudence of power. It is the delight of vulgar talent to dazzle and blind the beholder. But true genius seeks to defend us from ourselves, from itself. And the true genius will not impoverish, but will liberate and add new senses. So he's stating that there's a contrast here, an inevitable conflict between the vulgar and the genius. And of course, we see that in our day, in this day and age, because genius is A, taxed, and B, scorned and rejected. I found my missing passage.
I had a note on that sentence, the imbecility of men.
Yeah.
It's. I mean, the media continues to protect and encourage the impudicity of Obama. They are the imbeciles.
Yes. Okay, it was page 39, not 37. That's a typo in my notes. Thus we feed on genius and refresh ourselves from too much conversation with our mates and exult in the depth of nature in that direction in which he leads us. What indemnification is one great man for populations of pygmies? I like that. Every mother wishes one son a genius, though all the rest should be mediocre. But a new danger appears in the excess of influence of the great man. His attractions warp us from our place. We have become underlings and intellectual suicides. Ah, yonder in the horizon is our help, other great men, new qualities perhaps, counterweights and checks on each other. We cloy the honey of each peculiar greatness. Every hero becomes a bore at last. Perhaps Voltaire was not bad-hearted, yet he said of the good Jesus even, I pray you let me never hear that man's name again. Now, he's basically saying that humanity moves on, and at some point, we'll be way, way beyond the teachings of the Christ. That's a long way in the future, but we have to recognize that that's what the evolution of skill and talent is. We're constantly rejecting what worked 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago and replacing it with fresh ideas, all of which are in a continuum and logical development. He also says the reputation of the 19th century will one day be quoted as proof of its barbarism. And you may have noticed in David Mamet's book, he constantly makes a point by saying Jefferson was an adulterer. And of course, he's not saying that. He's quoting liberals and saying that as a way of tarnishing Jefferson so that modern liberals seem better people. So the reputation of the 19th century will one day be quoted as proof of its barbarism. And then the final quote, great men exist so that there may be greater men. That is a quote that should be inscribed on the over the door of Walden Grove. Great men exist so that there may be greater men and women. Oh, it's somewhere near the end. Okay, any further thoughts or comments here? On great men. Yeah.
I thought this was amazing piece of writing. I thought you mentioned the Trinity dimension. I started thinking that when I started reading it, but I started reading it. And that I was reading this morning, realized that those words, it's like this word that chooses, it's almost like a jewel that radiates, and it gives you more and more deep insight.
Yeah.
The thing was, about three quarters of the way, I went back and read the opening sentence and thought, you know, when I first read it, I thought, oh, the kid is natural to be that people read. At first reading, I thought, you know, all that means everybody does this. But when I went back and read it, that statement truly gave a different meaning. It was more or less that it is part of the plan.
So, just that first. So, to me, that's what I think. It's part of God's plan. There are great men, there are those who are lesser. Now, this is all good. Very good. Okay. All right, we go on then to the next period. And we've been reading the Ethics of Aristotle, I hope. And this is our session of the day on Aristotle. Aristotle next introduces the concept of the mean, by which he means the golden mean. It's not necessarily translated that way. It was not translated that way in my book, in my edition. But I think he assumed that everybody knew that when he said the mean, he meant the golden mean. Aristotle suggests that virtue lies in a balance between two opposites, i.e., the opposites of aggressiveness and cowardice, neither of which is acceptable. The mean or the virtue would be courage. And since you are all well schooled in my concept of the equilateral triangle as a diagram for thinking and reconciling duality, you instantly see the applicability of this idea. But it was a brilliant description back 2,000 years ago. Aristotle establishes the baseline of the triangle, aggression on one end, cowardice on the other. He then suggests that neither is the antidote for the other. You can't go from one end to the other. They both serve equally to embroil us in mischief and backtreading. but both expressed in moderation will converge on a mean, and that mean is the golden mean of virtue. But Rush Limbaugh, if you've listened to him at all, demonstrates some difficulty with this concept. Because, as he points out, there is no such thing as a moderate conservative or a moderate liberal. Either you're conservative or you're liberal, but if you're moderation just means you're unable to make up your mind. Now, I don't agree with that 100%, but he's got a point. Moderation simply weakens the strength of ideas. It's a dilution. Maybe we shouldn't call it moderation. We should call it diminishment or dilution. It does not serve the golden mean. On paper, Aristotle's approach makes sense, but it is easily misread, and it has been throughout the centuries. We might approach the mean through experience alone, but we can get there much more quickly by recognizing that the ethic already exists as a virtue among Plato's first principles. Our task is not to define it, but to activate it. The misinterpretation of Aristotle's idea of the mean, and I might say it's a deliberate misinterpretation, has caused Western philosophy to veer away from the abstract mind and heap disrespect upon it, which continues in our educational system even to this day. This error is still perpetuated also in scientific thinking, not in the true scientific method, but in what sloppy scientists refer to as scientific thinking. The whole notion that because of four or five so-called scientists say there's global warming is a proven fact is completely would be completely repugnant to Aristotle. I know, in this light, I know any number of people who insist that there is no such thing as revelation. The idea that there would be a virtue in the mind of God that can reveal itself to thinking people and geniuses, they just reject that outright. But a careful reading of ethics resolves these problems. He's not discarding the first principles as unimportant. He is merely saying that knowing that honesty is an ideal does not make a man honest. The inspiration must be forged in the character. It is by doing just acts, I'm quoting now, it is by doing just acts that the just man is produced, and by doing temperate acts, the temperate man. Without doing these, no one would have even a prospect of becoming good. Let's take a moment here to talk about that idea. I'll repeat it. It is by doing just acts that the just man is produced, and by doing temperate acts, the temperate man. Without doing these, no one would have even a prospect of becoming good. What does he say?
What I often hear you refer to as admiring an idea and not doing anything beyond that.
Uh-huh. Yes. So what do we have to do?
We have to kind of integrate the idea into our character.
Absolutely. And how is that done?
Things like the techniques you teach in meditation.
Well, they're useful, and they can accelerate the process, but what are they? They're just a codification for doing this. Okay. Rose?
You make things better by making them better. You roll up your sleeves and you do the work.
Okay. You take risks. You experiment. You try to express beauty, and if you fall short, you try again, and then you try again, and then you try again. Some of that, you're rehearsing the expression of beauty. Some of it can be done in the mind with meditation, and that can accelerate the process. But ultimately, it has to be grounded in the physical plane. You have to actually, it does no good to adopt an attitude of, I love all mankind, it's just individuals I hate. That implies that you don't love mankind either. To say you believe in Jesus but do nothing to honor the Christ principle in other people is hypocrisy. And this is where we run square block into hypocrisy. A little thinking is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or not at all the Pierian spring.
So this, again, would be where you would go back to the source. You don't accept failure, but you go back to the source and see where you've maybe gotten off track.
Sure.
And then you try again. And eventually you will succeed. You will triumph.
And there's no reason for any sense of failure or disappointment or whatever, because that's just the emotions trying to subvert your whole process. In fact, we should learn to embrace failure. And I this brings up an interesting point. This is taught in the first grade or two of any school, or it's not taught. It would be taught in Walnut Grove, and that is, if you're taking a math test and you get the answer wrong, that is not an indictment that you can't do math. It's just an indictment that you need to understand this principle better. And two-year-olds trying to learn to walk or talk, well, I guess it's a one-year-old trying to walk or something, but in that range, trying to walk, they fall, they get themselves back up again. They don't sit there and conclude, I can't learn to walk. I can't learn to talk. But by the time they're six or seven, they try to do a simpler addition or subtraction. And if they fail, they decide they have no talent for this. So it's very, very important for teachers in the early ages, early developmental ages, to get the point across. It's by doing that you learn. You learn by doing. You start with the ideal, but you learn by doing. And you learn by making mistakes. So it's okay. You have permission to make mistakes. And nobody's going to bite your head off or give you a failing grade. Other input here.
Just go ahead. As you make mistakes and try new things, and if you continue going into more levels, doing more, making more mistakes, higher level, etc. It just keeps moving you forward.
Yeah. A genius is simply a person who makes mistakes of a more sublime nature than the average person.
Nobody is up there.
Right. None of the rest of us know that we notice that it's a mistake because it sounds like brilliance to us. But they still make mistakes because they're human beings. Other input.
I think mistakes, or when you feel like yourself is really a prompt, which is everybody's saying the same thing, they have their place, they are motivators.
Absolutely. I wish the word failure didn't exist in terms of human beings. We can talk about an automobile failing, breaking down, failing. But for human beings, there are steps on the ladder. There are no failures. The first step or two takes you only part way, and therefore it's not a complete success. But you build upon failure. And that's such a liberating idea, and it's one that you may take for granted because you've heard it so often from me, but it's an important one. Now, we're not talking about the modern craze of self-esteem and whatnot and never telling anybody that they're wrong. We're teaching them that it's okay to make mistakes if you learn from them.
Well, it would be like if you were at the airport and you missed your flight.
You take the next one. Right.
It's no big deal. It's no failure. You just take the next one.
Yeah.
Example in my life is I have a dear friend who all just happened to have gone through divorces in the past few years. And just the other night we were talking about how much we discovered about ourselves and what we are capable of doing that perhaps we never would have even imagined or thought. Even stupid little things like around the house, you know, I can do that, I can fix that.
Yeah.
Figure this electrical thing out, even though I never would have attempted to do it previously. So.
Yes, in many cases, divorce is a liberation, especially if the marriage is breaking up because there's an imbalance and somebody's being manipulated by the other person. Every life experience has tremendous richness of opportunity in it. There's nothing that you can experience on earth that should throw you into a depression. Nothing. And we learn that. The more we learn that, the more we learn to take life in stride no matter what it is, the healthier we become. Yes.
This was when you brought up your triangle.
Yeah.
Of aggressiveness, cowardice, and then courage at the top. What popped into my mind was the Norway massacre.
Oh, yeah.
Because just yesterday I saw in the Daily where this guy is going to be staying. This was like a one-room efficiency apartment. It had a little fridge in there. It had a separate bathroom for him. I mean, are they going to learn from this? That's how they're going to treat this guy.
Yeah, well, that's the corruption of the socialist point of view. You treat criminals better than you treat ordinary people. And yes, that's a good way not to learn the lesson. He knew that going in, that
yeah.
He'd be coddled, so what's the point? What's to deter him from killing 92 people, which he did, or 93, if that's all that's going to happen to him? It's a joke.
And some people, even in the news, said this is not going to change us. Nobody's going to change us.
Well,
so you know they're not going to learn from that lesson.
Right. Let me go on and read a little bit more. Bring another quote from Ethics. Virtue then is a state of character concerned with choice. Lying in a mean, this being determined by a rational principle, and by that principle by which a man of practical wisdom would determine it. So this is a treatise, the Ethics of Aristotle, is a treatise on practical wisdom, how you apply philosophy to daily life. And it's not a contradiction of Plato or Socrates, it's an explanation of how you ground those ideas into a system of practical wisdom and living. It would be a goal of Walden Grove to produce scholars of practical wisdom, students who are capable of putting ideas to work in their life. So what does this idea of practical wisdom mean to you in your life? Comments and questions.
I know you have taught us to not look at something as a problem, but as an opportunity. Would that be a practical application?
Well, that's part of it, sure. Just the working with the triangle is a resolution. It's not recognizing that you're trapped in one baseline or the other, one end of the baseline or the other, nobody is trapped. Thinking springs the trap. And so the idea here is to translate this into practical situations. The whole purpose of ethics is to give us a means by which we can decide how we want to act, how we want other people to act in practical ways, moment to moment, throughout our day. And then we work to live up to those standards. Other input. Speak up, please. Almost.
Okay. In one class, I can remember someone talking about how we have certain expectations, conventions, ways that people need to behave in certain situations. Like, the explanation was, for example, on a highway, you were expecting that the cars would that's going to be best for the law. Stay with the link, go to the direction they use the, you know, turn signals or whatever to let you know the next move. And I'm thinking, taking that very mundane example, something like this, in terms of that, would it not be fabulous, just truly fabulous, if we could count on others to express that virtue?
Well, this is where mass consciousness actually is a benevolent force rather than a negative force. Because to us, we're aware of the mean or the average in mass consciousness, which right now, with all the uncertainty politically and whatnot, is filled with fear and trepidation and panic. And we're sensitive to that, and we try to clean that up. But in a situation like you just referred to in driving, the idea that people stay in their lanes and use turn signals and whatnot, mass consciousness accepts that as a standard, as the mean. Mass consciousness does not approve of people making up their own rules when driving. It still happens, but everybody pretty much knows that unless everybody drives predictably, they'll get in a wreck sooner or later. It's the erratic behavior that produces wrecks, not the predictable behavior. And so mass consciousness helps tame the savage beast of the of the lower half of the population. And so we are fairly well schooled in the simple things such as driving that that create accidents. Of course, the cliche here, the cliche rebuttal to that is that teenagers who have only had a year or two experience driving go out on graduation night and get drunk and drive their car into a tree and kill 8 kids. That's because they haven't responded to the mean, to the standard of mass consciousness, to the standard of that the adult has learned that their survival on the freeway depends on everybody doing the predictable. So that's a good example of how these things work. And I think it was probably Matt in his book that brought that illustration up rather than Aristotle, because I don't recall Aristotle having a Mercedes to drive. There was, Rose was telling me, speaking of such things, Rose was reading me something from the Daily this morning, where there was some European
country.
I think
it was in Monaco. Oh
yeah, in Monaco. There was a wreck involving a Bentley, a Ferrari, a Mercedes, a Porsche, and
an Aston Martin.
And my comment was that the Bentley was a $400,000 car. The Mercedes was the
cheapest
of the five cars at $121,000. And I said, this is bad publicity for Mercedes to be the cheapest in a five-car wreck. And it just indicates how our standards vary depending upon what our baseline is. The joke there is that a $121,000 car turns out to be cheap compared to the $400,000 Bentley and the $350,000 Ferrari.
And the repair bills for the insurance company were going to be $643,000.
So anyway, getting back to practical wisdom, what does it mean to you?
I guess it in some way it's so hopeful in that by studying, by thinking, by acting out, trying to put things into daily life, we can really build and develop this wisdom. And so it's tapping into wisdom, making it practical in your life.
Good. I know that as you've read this, you probably thought, my God, this is philosophical mush. Why are we reading this? But as we get into this section where Aristotle is now talking about how ethics are generated, this becomes a tremendous model or archetype, prototype for defining first principles, virtues, and creating values that become our ethics and creating a standard. This involves prioritizing. It involves he makes a further distinction that ethics are the product of choice. Somebody needs to mute their button. Judy, can you mute your button so we don't hear the conversation in the background?
No, at the very basic level, it seems like he's talking about the golden mean.
Well, he is talking about the golden mean.
The golden rule. The do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Well, of course, Mam A brings that up in our reading.
You could mute it or something.
Well,
then nobody can talk.
Yeah, nobody can talk. So, ethics are the product of deliberation, deliberate thought. But we don't deliberate about divine things. We don't invent virtue. We deliberate on how to express virtue. We accept virtue as an archetype of the mind of God, as a first principle. And then we deliberate on what does it mean to be an agent of beauty? What does it mean to be an agent of harmony? What does it mean to be an agent of peace? Well, it means we have to, you don't just love peace and demand it from others, you have to act in peaceful ways yourself. You have to become a peacemaker. And that's where the modern thinker often falls flat. Okay, other comments or insights about this approach to virtue and ethics? Talk up.
It's starting to comment on that it was receiver. And that is practical.
Yes.
So even though it may take some time to learn the techniques to clean up, emotions or whatever, and any negativity, it really makes the way ahead so much easier for us.
Sure.
Talk about being practical, it's almost silly not to do it, but yet we fall backwards and, into our old habits. And I think we're all learning that including these principles truly are practical.
Right. Now, you've all heard, I'm sure, the really stupid statement that there's no owner's manual issued with human life. Well, here is an owner's manual. This is a how-to. This is philosophy that codifies practical wisdom. And it's available for every one of us to study. It's the owner's manual, part of it, and a very important part of it on ethics. And so there are owner's manuals. There are instruction manuals on how to be a decent human being. The Bible is one of them. This is one of them. And therefore, these things will be included in Walden Grove because a child ought to grow up learning how to work with virtue and ethics. It's such a simple process, and it clarifies the confusing elements of human life. Okay, any final observations on this discussion of ethics?
I think it was a misception where Aristotle, I was getting kind of confused because he was talking about people who don't get it or don't understand maybe are not guilty when they do something.
Oh, ignorance, yeah.
Ignorance. And I guess what I'm thinking here is that in practical experiences, we are teaching others, bringing them to that consciousness slowly. But
right. Well, this is where the deficiency, I think, of what Aristotle is saying is he doesn't include any awareness of mass consciousness here, that humanity learns as a group and that it may be an element to consider if somebody is incapable of or is ignorant of the rules, but it's their duty and obligation to learn that. And then if they transgress it, the punishment teaches them more quickly. We don't condemn them. We shouldn't even condemn the fellow in Norway for killing 93 people. But we don't want to mollycoddle them. We want, this is the purpose of capital punishment. We want to make sure that he gets the message that you don't do this without paying the consequences. Because life will expose him to that consequence. He, whether it's in this lifetime or 20 lifetimes to come, he's going to learn the hard way that you don't go around blowing people off the face of the earth. That's a no-no. So the more we can, this is not the Ten Commandments saying thou shalt not do this. This is an instruction on how do you create ethics that will make your life simpler and give you a reasonable expectation of that other people will behave in predictable ways? Okay.
The point before was that if we do these practical things, that in some way we are reaching out to people who just don't get it.
Yeah. Well, philosophy is the way in which people have, the study of philosophy has been the way in which people have learned to think historically. It hasn't always done a good job, but correctly taught, it can become a mighty weapon of enlightenment. And that's the role of reading philosophy in Walden Grove. Not to become philosophers ourselves, but to become thinkers. Very good. Yes.
Carl, can I make just one other comment?
Sure.
I'm thinking in terms of this owner's manual. It means that it really doesn't matter what the events or happenings are in one's life. We have the first principles. We have the owner's manual to deal with whatever it is.
Yes. I'm sorry. I just got disconnected for a moment. Summarize that one more time.
Sure. I was saying that the idea of an owner's manual, in my mind, is really reinforcing that it doesn't matter what the events of our daily lives are. We have first principles, guidelines. We have this owner's manual. No matter what it is, we can learn from it, move on. It's a guide for us.
Sure. And it also means that great men have left behind the clues that allow them their ideas to survive for thousands of years, and in this case, 2,500 years. Excellent. Excellent. Whoops. I'm in here somewhere.
Turn sideways.
Yeah. Close me. Okay, that's it for this morning. We'll have lunch, and then from 1:15 to 2, you have your assignment, your independent research project to work on, and we will resume at 2 o'clock. See you then. Oh, I'm going to disconnect this time to see whether that improves our echoing problem at all.
You don't want to shut down the meeting.
No. So I will have to re-invite everybody about 10 minutes till 2. So don't be alarmed if I disappear. Everybody is disappearing.
Was Nancy not on
there anymore? Yeah, she was on your body.
She had to work today.
The organizer has ended the session, and this call will be disconnected. Goodbye.
Yeah, I said I would.
I kept thinking that thing wasn't on.
Well, the inboard.
However, after you turned it on, I could actually see Dorothy's.
Okay.
On there.
Well, that's why we do it. But
yeah.
But that shouldn't have had anything to do with it, because it was the output. It's speaking of output. This is input.
Oh.
So.
Well.